we want to find out. And soon, before these computers leave the plant.
They're being shipped out on the 31st of March, Mrs. Jones added. Only about 2 weeks from now. She glanced at Blunt. He nodded. That's why it's essential for us to send someone else to Port Talon. Someone to continue where your uncle left off.
Alex smiled queasily. I hope you're not looking at me.
We can't just send in another agent, Mrs. Jones said. The enemy has shown his hand. He's killed Ryder. He'll be expecting a replacement. Somehow we have to trick him.
We have to send in someone who won't be noticed, Blunt continued. Someone who can look around and report back without being seen themselves. We were considering sending down a woman. She might be able to slip in as a secretary or receptionist. But then I had a better idea. A few months ago, one of these computer magazines ran a competition. Be the first boy or girl to use the Stormbreaker. Travel to Port Talon and meet Herod Sale himself. That was the first prize. And it was won by some young chap who was apparently a bit of a whiz kid when it comes to computers. Name of Felix Lester, 14 years old. The same age as you. He looks a bit like you, too. He's expected down at Port Talon less than 2 weeks from now.
Wait a minute.
You've already shown yourself to be extraordinarily brave and resourceful, Blunt said. First of all at the Breaker's Yard. That was a karate kick, wasn't it? How long have you been learning karate?
Alex didn't answer, so he went on.
And then there was that little test we arranged for you at the bank. Any boy who would climb out of a 15th-floor window just to satisfy his own curiosity has to be rather special. And it seems to me that you are very special indeed.
What we're suggesting is that you come and work for us, Mrs. Jones said. We have enough time to give you some basic training, not that you'll need it, probably, and we can equip you with a few items that may help you with what we have in mind. Then we'll arrange for you to take the place of this other boy. You will go to Sale Enterprises on the 29th of March. That's when this Lester boy is expected. You'll stay there until the 1st of April, which is the day of the ceremony. The timing couldn't be better. You'll be able to meet Herod Sale, keep an eye on him, and tell us what you think. Perhaps you'll also find out what it was your uncle discovered and why he had to die. You shouldn't be in any danger. After all, who would suspect a 14-year-old boy of being a spy?
All we're asking you to do is to report back to us, Blunt said. That's all we want. 2 weeks of your time. A chance to make sure these computers are everything they're cracked up to be. A chance to serve your country.
Blunt had finished his dinner. His plate was completely clean, as if there had never been any food on it at all. He put down his knife and fork, laying them precisely side by side.
All right, Alex, he said. So what do you say? There was a long pause.
Blunt was watching him with polite interest. Mrs. Jones was unwrapping yet another peppermint, her black eyes seemingly fixed on the twist of paper in her hands. No, Alex said.
I'm sorry?
It's a dumb idea. I don't want to be a spy, I want to be a footballer. Anyway, I have a life of my own.
He found it difficult to choose the right words. The whole thing was so preposterous, he almost wanted to laugh.
Why don't you ask this Felix Lester to snoop around for you?
We don't believe he'd be as resourceful as you, Blunt said.
He's probably better at computer games.
Alex shook his head.
I'm sorry, I'm just not interested. I don't want to get involved.
That's a pity, Blunt said.
His tone of voice hadn't changed, but there was a heavy, dead quality to the words, and there was something different, too, about him. Throughout the meal, he had been polite, not friendly, but at least human. In an instant, that had disappeared. Alex thought of a toilet chain being pulled. The human part of him had just been flushed away.
Then we'd better move on to discuss your future, he continued. Like it or not, Alex, the Royal and General is now your legal guardian.
I thought you said the Royal and General didn't exist.
Blunt ignored him. Ian Ryder has, of course, left the house and all his money to you. However, he left it in trust until you are 21, and we control that trust. So there will, I'm afraid, have to be some changes. The American girl who lives with you, Jack, Miss Starbright, her visa has expired. She'll be returned to America. We propose to put the house on the market. Unfortunately, you have no relatives to look after you, so I'm afraid that also means you'll have to leave Brooklyn. You'll be sent to an institution. There's one I know just outside Birmingham. The St. Elizabeth in Sawbridge. Not a very pleasant place, but I'm afraid there's no alternative.
You're blackmailing me, Alex exclaimed.
Not at all.
But if I agree to do what you ask... Blunt glanced at Mrs. Jones. Help us and we'll help you, she said.
Alex considered, but not for very long. He had no choice and he knew it. Not when these people controlled his money, his present life, his entire future.
You talked about training, he said. Mrs. Jones nodded. That's why we brought you here, Alex. This is a training center. If you agree to what we want, we can start at once.
Start at once. Alex spoke the three words without liking the sound of them. Blunt and Mrs. Jones were waiting for his answer. He sighed. Yeah, all right. It doesn't look like I've got very much choice. He glanced at the slices of cold lamb on his plate. Dead meat. Suddenly he knew how it felt. Chapter 5. 00 Nothing. For the 100th time, Alex cursed Alan Blunt, using language he hadn't even realized he knew. It was almost 5 o'clock in the evening, although it could have been 5 o'clock in the morning. The sky had barely changed at all throughout the day. It was grey, cold, unforgiving. The rain was still falling, a thin drizzle that travelled horizontally in the wind, soaking through his supposedly waterproof clothing, mixing with his sweat and his dirt, chilling him to the bone. He unfolded his map and checked his position once again. He had to be close to the last RV of the day, the last rendezvous point, but he could see nothing. He was standing on a narrow track made up of loose grey shingle that crunched under his combat boots when he walked. The track snaked round the side of a mountain, with a sheer drop to the right. He was somewhere in the Brecon Beacons, and there should have been a view, but it had been wiped out by the rain and the fading light. A few trees twisted out of the side of the hill, with leaves as hard as thorns. Behind him, below him, ahead of him, it was all the same. Nowhere land. Alex hurt. The 10-kilogram Bergen rucksack he had been forced to wear cut into his shoulders and had rubbed blisters on his back. His right knee, where he had fallen earlier in the day, was no longer bleeding, but still stung. His shoulder was bruised and there was a gash along the side of his neck. His camouflage outfit, he had swapped his Gap combat trousers for the real thing, fitted him badly, cutting his legs and under his arms, but hanging loose everywhere else. He was close to exhaustion, he knew, almost too tired to feel how much pain he was in. But for the glucose and caffeine tablets in his survival pack, he would have ground to a halt hours ago. He knew that if he didn't find the RV soon, he would be physically unable to continue. Then he would be thrown off the course. Binned, as they called it. They would like that. Swallowing down the taste of defeat, Alex folded the map and forced himself on. It was his 9th, or maybe his 10th, day of training. Time had begun to dissolve into itself, as shapeless as the rain. After his lunch, with Alan Blunt and Mrs. Jones, he had been moved out of the manor house and into a crude wooden hut in the training camp a few miles away. There were 9 huts in total, each equipped with 4 metal beds and 4 metal lockers. A 5th had been squeezed into one of them to accommodate Alex. 2 more huts, painted a different color, stood side by side. One of these was a kitchen and mess hall. The other contained toilets, sinks, and showers, with not a single hot tap in sight. On his first day there, Alex had been introduced to his training officer, an incredibly fit black sergeant. He was a sort of man who thought he'd seen everything, until he saw Alex. And he had examined the new arrival for a long minute before he had spoken. It's not my job to ask questions, he had said. But if it was, I'd want to know what they're thinking of.
sending me children.
Do you have any idea where you are, boy? This isn't Butlin's. This isn't the Club Mediterranee.
He cut the word into its five syllables and spat them out.
I have you for 11 days, and they expect me to give you the sort of training that should take 14 weeks.
That's not just mad.
That's suicidal.
I didn't ask to be here, Alex had said. Suddenly the sergeant was furious.
You don't speak to me unless I give you permission,
he shouted.
And when you speak to me, you address me as sir. Do you understand?
Yes, sir. Alex had already decided that the man was even worse than his geography teacher.
There are 5 units operational here at the moment, the officer went on. You'll join K unit. We don't use names. I have no name, you have no name. If anyone asks you what you're doing, you tell them nothing. Some of the men may be hard on you, some of them may resent you for being here. That's too bad. You'll just have to live with it. And there's something else you need to know. I can make allowances for you. You're a boy, not a man. But if you complain, you'll be binned. If you cry, you'll be binned. If you can't keep up, you'll be binned.
Between you and me, boy, this is a mistake, and I want to bin you.
After that, Alex joined K Unit. As the sergeant had predicted, they weren't exactly overjoyed to see him. There were 4 of them. As Alex was soon to discover, the Special Operations Division of MI6 sent its agents to the same training center used by the Special Air Service, the SAS. Much of the training was based on SAS methods, and this included the numbers and makeup of each team. So there were 4 men, each with their own special skills, and 1 boy, seemingly with none. They were all in their mid-20s, spread out over the bunks in companionable silence. 2 of them smoking, 1 dismantling and reassembling his gun, a 9mm Browning high-power pistol. Each of them had been given a code name: Wolf, Fox, Eagle, and Snake. From now on, Alex would be known as Cub. The leader, Wolf, was the one with the gun. He was short and muscular, with square shoulders and black, close-cropped hair. He had a handsome face, made slightly uneven by his nose, which had been broken at some time in the past. He was the first to speak. Putting the gun down, he examined Alex with cold, dark grey eyes.
So who the hell do you think you are? He demanded.
Cub, Alex replied.
A bloody schoolboy.
Wolf spoke with a strange, slightly foreign accent.
I don't believe it. Are you with Special Operations?
I'm not allowed to tell you that, Alex went over to his bunk and sat down. The mattress felt as solid as the frame. Despite the cold, there was only 1 blanket. Wolf shook his head and smiled humorlessly.
Look at what they've sent us, he muttered. 007, 00 nothing more like.
After that, the name stuck. 00 nothing was what they called him. In the days that followed, Alex shadowed the group. Not quite part of it, but never far away. Almost everything they did, he did. He learned map reading, radio communication, and first aid. He took part in unarmed combat class and was knocked to the ground so often that it took all his nerve to persuade him to get up again. And then there was the assault course. 5 times he was shouted and bullied across the nightmare of nets and ladders, tunnels and ditches, swinging tightropes and towering walls that stretched for almost 0.5 kilometer through and over the woodland beside the huts. Alex thought of it as the adventure playground from hell. The first time he tried it, he fell off a rope and into a pit that seemed to have been filled on purpose with freezing slime. Half drowned and filthy, he had been sent back to the start by the sergeant. Alex thought he would never get to the end, but the second time he finished it in 25 minutes, which he cut to 17 minutes by the end of the week. Bruised and exhausted though he was quietly pleased with himself. Even Wolf only managed it in 12. Wolf remained actively hostile towards Alex. The other 3 men simply ignored him, but Wolf did everything he could to taunt or humiliate him. It was as if Alex had somehow insulted him by being placed in the group. Once, crawling under the nets, Wolf lashed out with his foot, missing Alex's face by a centimeter. Of course, he would have said it was an accident if the boot had connected. Another time, he was more successful. tripping Alex up in the mess hall and sending him flying, along with his tray, cutlery, and steaming plate of stew. And every time he spoke to Alex, he used the same sneering tone of voice.
Good night, 00 Nothing. Don't whip the bid.
Alex bit his lip and said nothing. But he was glad when the four men were sent off for a day's jungle survival course. That wasn't part of his own training. Even though the sergeant worked him twice as hard once they were gone, he preferred to be on his own. But on the 8th day, Wolf did come close to finishing him altogether. It happened in the Killing House. The Killing House was a fake, a mock-up of an embassy used to train the SAS in the art of hostage release. Alex had twice watched K-Unit go into the house, the first time swinging down from the roof, and had followed their progress on closed-circuit TV. All four men were armed. Alex himself didn't take part because someone somewhere had decided he shouldn't carry a gun. Inside the Killing House, mannequins had been arranged as terrorists and hostages, smashing down the doors and using stun grenades to clear the rooms with deafening multiple blasts. Wolf, Fox, Eagle, and Snake had successfully completed their mission both times. This time, Alex had joined them. The Killing House had been booby-trapped. They weren't told how. All five of them were unarmed. Their job was simply to get from one end of the house to the other without being killed. They almost made it. In the first room, made up to look like a huge dining room, they found the pressure pads under the carpet and the infrared beams across the doors. For Alex, it was an eerie experience, tiptoeing behind the other four men, watching as they dismantled the two devices, using cigarette smoke to expose the otherwise invisible beams. It was strange to be afraid of everything and yet see nothing. In the hallway, there was a motion detector, which would have activated a machine gun. Alex assumed it was loaded with blanks, behind a Japanese screen. The third room was empty. The fourth was a living room with the exit, a set of French windows, on the other side. There was a tripwire barely thicker than a human hair, running the entire width of the room, and the French windows were alarmed. While Snake dealt with the alarm, Fox and Eagle prepared to neutralize the tripwire, unclipping an electronic circuit board and a variety of tools from their belts. Wolf stopped them.
Leave it. We're out of here.
At the same moment, Snake signaled. He had deactivated the alarm. The French windows were open. Snake was the first out, then Fox and Eagle. Alex would have been the last to leave the room, but just as he reached the exit, he found Wolf blocking his way.
Tough luck, 00 Nothing, Wolf said.
His voice was soft, almost kind. The next thing Alex knew, the heel of Wolf's palm had rammed into his chest, pushing him back with astonishing force. Taken by surprise, he lost his balance and fell, remembered the tripwire and tried to twist his body to avoid it, but it was hopeless. His flailing left hand caught the wire. He actually felt it against his wrist. He hit the floor, pulling the wire with him, and then... The HRT stun grenade has been used frequently by the SAS. It's a small device, filled with a mixture of magnesium powder and mercury fulminate. When the tripwire activated the grenade, the mercury exploded at once, not just deafening Alex, but shuddering through him, as if it could rip out his heart. At the same time, the magnesium ignited and burned for a full 10 seconds. The light was so blinding that even closing his eyes made no difference. Alex lay there with his face against the hard wooden floor, his hands scrabbling against his head, unable to move, waiting for it to end. But even then, it wasn't over. When the magnesium finally burned out, it was as if all the light had burned out with it. Alex stumbled to his feet, unable to see or hear, not even sure anymore where he was. He felt sick to his stomach. The room swayed about him. The heavy smell of chemicals hung in the air. 10 minutes later, he staggered out into the open. Wolf was waiting for him with the others, his face blank, and Alex realized he must have slipped out before he'd hit the ground. An angry sergeant walked over to him. Alex hadn't expected to see a shred of concern in the man's face, and he wasn't disappointed.
"Do you want to tell me what happened in there, cub?" he demanded.
When Alex didn't answer, he went on,
"You ruined the exercise. You fouled up. You could get the whole unit binned, so you better start telling me what went wrong."
Alex glanced at Wolf. Wolf looked the other way. What should he say? Should he even try to tell the truth?
"Well?"
The sergeant was waiting. "Nothing happened, sir," Alex said.
I just wasn't looking where I was going. I stepped on something and there was an explosion.
If that was real life, you'd be dead, the sergeant said. What did I tell you? Sending me a child was a mistake, and a stupid, clumsy child who doesn't look where he's going, that's even worse.
Alex stood where he was, just taking it. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Wolf half smiling. The sergeant had seen it too.
You think it's so funny, Wolf? You can go and clean up in there, and tonight you'd better get some rest, all of you. Because tomorrow you've got a 40-kilometer hike. Survival rations. No fire. This is a survival course. And if you do survive, then maybe you'll have a reason to smile.
Alex remembered the words now. Exactly 24 hours later. He had spent the last 11 of them on his feet, following the trail the sergeant had set out for him on the map. The exercise had begun at 6 o'clock in the morning, after a grey-lit breakfast of sausages and beans. Wolf and the others had disappeared into the distance ahead of him a long time ago, even though they had been given 25-kilogram rucksacks to carry. They had also been given only 8 hours to complete the course. Allowing for his age, Alex had been given 12. He rounded a corner, his feet scrunching on the gravel. There was someone standing ahead of him. It was the sergeant. He had just lit a cigarette, and Alex watched him slide the matches back into his pocket. Seeing him there brought back the shame and the anger of the day before, and at the same time sapped the last of his strength. Suddenly Alex had had enough of Blunt, Mrs. Jones, Wolf, the whole stupid thing. With a final effort, he stumbled the last 100 meters and came to a halt. Rain and sweat trickled down the side of his face. His hair, now dark with grime, was glued across his forehead. The sergeant looked at his watch.
11 hours, 5 minutes. That's not bad, cub. But the others were here 3 hours ago.
Bully for them, Alex thought. He didn't say anything.
Anyway, you should just make it to the last RV, the sergeant went on. It's up there.
He pointed to a wall. Not a sloping wall, a sheer one. Solid rock, rising 50 meters up, without a handhold or a foothold in sight. Even looking at it, Alex felt his stomach shrink. Ian Ryder had taken him climbing, in Scotland, in France, all over Europe. But he had never attempted anything as difficult as this. Not on his own. Not when he was so tired. I can't, he said. In the end, the two words came out easily.
I didn't hear that, the sergeant said.
I said I can't do it, sir.
Can't isn't a word we use around here.
I don't care. I've had enough. I've just had... Alex's voice cracked. He didn't trust himself to go on. He stood there, cold and empty, waiting for the axe to fall. But it didn't. The sergeant gazed at him for a long minute. He nodded his head slowly.
Listen to me, cub, he said. I know what happened in the killing house.
Alex glanced up.
Wolf forgot about the closed-circuit TV. We've got it all on film.
Then why... Alex began.
Did you make a complaint against him, cub?
No, sir.
Do you want to make a complaint against him, cub?
A pause. Then, no, sir.
Good,
the sergeant pointed at the rock face, suggesting a path up with his finger.
It's not as difficult as it looks, he said. They're waiting for you just over the top. You've got a nice cold dinner. Survival rations. You don't want to miss that.
Alex drew a deep breath and started forward. As he passed the sergeant, he stumbled and put out a hand to steady himself, brushing against him. Sorry, sir. He said. It took him 20 minutes to reach the top, and sure enough, K Unit was already there, crouching around 3 small tents that they must have pitched earlier in the afternoon. 2 for 2 men sharing, 1, the smallest, for Alex. Snake, a thin, fair-haired man who spoke with a Scottish accent, looked up at Alex. He had a tin of cold stew in one hand, a teaspoon in the other.
I didn't think you'd make it, he said.
Alex couldn't help but notice a certain warmth in the man's voice. And for the first time he hadn't called him 00 nothing. Nor did I, Alex said. Wolf was squatting over what he hoped would become a campfire, trying to get it started with 2 flints, while Fox and Eagle watched. He was getting nowhere. The stones only produced the smallest of sparks,
and the scraps of newspaper and leaves that he had collected were already far too wet. Wolf struck at the stones again and again. The others watched, their faces glum. Alex held out the box of matches that he had pickpocketed from the sergeant when he had pretended to stumble at the foot of the rock face. "These might help," he said. He threw the matches down, then went into his tent.
Chapter 6. Toys Aren't Us. In the London office, Mrs. Jones sat waiting while Alan Blunt read the report. The sun was shining. A pigeon was strutting back and forth along the ledge outside, as if keeping guard.
"He's doing very well," Blunt said at last. "Remarkably well, in fact." He turned a page. "I see he missed target practice."
"Were you planning to give him a gun?" Mrs. Jones asked.
"No, I don't think that would be a good idea."
"Then why does he need target practice?"
Blunt raised an eyebrow.
"We can't give a teenager a gun," he said. "On the other hand, I don't think we should send him to Port Talon empty-handed. You'd better have a word with Smithers."
"I already have. He's working on it now."
Mrs. Jones stood up as if to leave, but at the door she hesitated.
"I wonder if it's occurred to you that Ryder may have been preparing him for this all along," she said.
"What do you mean?"
"Preparing Alex to replace him. Ever since the boy was old enough to walk, he's been in training for intelligence work, but without knowing it. I mean, he's lived abroad, so he now speaks French, German, and Spanish. He's been mountain climbing, diving, and skiing. He's learned karate. Physically, he's in perfect shape." She shrugged. "I think Ryder wanted Alex to become a spy."
"But not so soon," Blunt said.
"I agree. You know as well as I do, Alan. He's not ready yet. If we send him into Sale Enterprises, he's going to get himself killed."
"Perhaps." The single word was cold, matter of fact.
"He's 14 years old. We can't do it."
"We have to."
Blunt stood up and opened the window, letting in the air and the sound of the traffic. The pigeon hurled itself off the ledge, afraid of him.
"This whole business worries me," he said. "The Prime Minister sees the Stormbreakers as a major coup for himself and for his government. But there's still something about Herod's Sale that I don't like. Did you tell the boy about Yasin Grigorovich?"
"No."
Mrs. Jones shook her head.
"Then it's time you did. It was Yasin who killed his uncle, I'm sure of it. And if Yasin was working for Sale..."
"What will you do if Yasin kills Alex, Ryder?"
"That's not our problem, Mrs. Jones. If the boy gets himself killed, it will be the final proof that there is something wrong. At the very least, it will allow me to postpone the Stormbreaker project and take a good, hard look at what's going on at Port Talon. In a way, it would almost help us if he was killed."
"The boy is not ready yet. He'll make mistakes. It won't take them long to find out who he is."
Mrs. Jones sighed.
"I don't think Alex has got much chance at all."
"I agree."
Blunt turned back from the window. The sun slanted over his shoulder. A single shadow fell across his face.
"But it's too late to worry about that now," he said. "We have no more time. Stop the training. Send him in."
Alex sat hunched in the back of the low-flying C-130 military aircraft, his stomach churning behind his knees. There were 12 men sitting in two lines around him, his own unit and two others. For an hour now, the plane had been flying at just 100 meters, following the Welsh valleys, dipping and swerving to avoid the mountain peaks. A single bulb glowed red behind a wire mesh, adding to the heat in the cramped cabin. Alex could feel the engines vibrating through him. It was like traveling in a spin dryer and microwave oven combined. The thought of jumping out of a plane with an oversized silk umbrella would have made Alex sick with fear. But only that morning he'd been told that he wouldn't, in fact, be jumping himself. A signal from London. They couldn't risk him breaking a leg, it said. And Alex guessed that the end of his training was near. Even so, he'd been taught how to pack a parachute, how to control it, how to exit a plane, and how to land. And at the end of the day, the sergeant had instructed him to join the flight, just for the experience. Now, close to the drop zone, Alex felt almost disappointed. He'd watch everyone else jump, and then he'd be left alone.
P-5.
The voice of the pilot came over the speaker system, distant, and metallic. Alex gritted his teeth. 5 minutes until the jump. He looked at the other men, shuffling into position, checking the cords that connected them to the static line. He was sitting next to Wolf. To his surprise, the man was completely quiet, unmoving. It was hard to tell in the half-darkness, but the look on his face could almost have been fear. There was a loud buzz, and the red light turned green. The assistant pilot had climbed through from the cockpit. He reached for a handle and pulled open a door set in the back of the aircraft, allowing the cold air to rush in. Alex could see a single square of night. It was raining. The rain howled past. The green light began to flash. The assistant pilot tapped the first pair on their shoulders, and Alex watched them shuffle over to the side and then throw themselves out. For a moment, they were there, frozen in the doorway. Then they were gone, like a photograph crumpled and spun away by the wind. Two more men followed, then another two, until only the final pair had still to jump. Alex glanced at Wolf, who seemed to be struggling with a piece of equipment. His partner was moving to the door without him, but still Wolf didn't look up. The other man jumped. Suddenly Alex was aware that only he and Wolf were left.
"Move it!"
the assistant pilot shouted above the roar of the engines. Wolf picked himself up. His eyes briefly met Alex's, and at that moment Alex knew. Wolf was a popular leader. He was tough and he was fast, completing a 40-kilometer hike as if it was just a stroll in the park. But he had a weak spot. Somehow he'd allowed this parachute jump to get to him, and he was too scared to move. It was hard to believe, but there he was, frozen in the doorway, his arms rigid, staring out. Alex glanced back. The assistant pilot was looking the other way. He hadn't seen what was happening. And when he did, if Wolf failed to make the jump, it would be the end of his training, and maybe even the end of his career. Even hesitating would be bad enough. He'd be binned. Alex thought for a moment. Wolf hadn't moved. Alex could see his shoulders rising and falling as he tried to summon up the courage to go. 10 seconds had passed, maybe more. The assistant pilot was leaning down, stowing away a piece of equipment. Alex stood up.
"Wolf!"
he said. Wolf didn't even hear him. Alex took one last quick look at the assistant pilot, then kicked out with all his strength. His foot slammed into Wolf's backside. He'd put all his strength behind it. Wolf was caught by surprise, his hands coming free as he plunged into the swirling night air. The assistant pilot turned round and saw Alex.
"What are you doing?"
he shouted.
"Just stretching my legs,"
Alex shouted back. The plane curved in the air and began the journey home. Mrs. Jones was waiting for him when he walked into the hangar. She was sitting at a table, wearing a grey silk jacket and trousers, with a black handkerchief flowing out of her top pocket. For a moment, she didn't recognize him. Alex was dressed in a flying suit. His hair was damp from the rain, his face was pinched with tiredness, and he seemed to have grown older very fast. None of the men had arrived back yet. A truck had been sent to collect them from a field about 3 kilometers away.
"Alex," she said.
Alex looked at her but said nothing.
"It was my decision to stop you jumping," she said. "I hope you're not disappointed. I just thought it was too much of a risk. Please, sit down."
Alex sat down opposite her.
"I have something that might cheer you up," she went on. "I brought you some toys."
"I'm too old for toys," Alex said.
"Not these toys."
She signaled and a man appeared, walking out of the shadows, carrying a tray of equipment, which he set down on the table. The man was enormously fat. When he sat down, the metal chair disappeared beneath the spread of his buttocks, and Alex was surprised it could even take his weight. He was bald, with a black moustache and several chins, each one melting into the next, and finally into his neck and shoulders. He wore a pinstriped suit, which must have used enough material to make a tent.
"Smithers," he said, nodding at Alex. "Very nice to meet you, old chap."
"What have you got for him?"
Mrs. Jones demanded.
"Well, I'm afraid we haven't had a great deal of time, Mrs. J,"
Smithers replied.
"The challenge was to think what a 14-year-old might carry with him and adapt it."
He picked the first object off the tray. A yo-yo. It was slightly larger than normal, made of black plastic.
Let's start with this, Smithers said.
Alex shook his head. He couldn't believe any of this. Don't tell me, he exclaimed. It's some sort of secret weapon.
Not exactly. I was told you weren't to have weapons. You're too young.
So it's not really a hand grenade. Pull the string and run like hell.
Certainly not. It's a yo-yo.
Smithers pulled out the string, holding it between a podgy finger and thumb.
However, the string is a special sort of nylon. Very advanced. There are 30 meters of it, and it can lift weights up to 100 kilograms. The actual yo-yo is motorized and clips onto your belt. Very useful for climbing.
Amazing, Alex said, unimpressed.
And then there's this.
Smithers produced a small tube. Alex read the side. Zitclean, the healthier skin.
Nothing personal, Smithers went on apologetically, but we thought it was something a boy of your age might use. And it is rather remarkable.
He opened the tube and squeezed some of the cream onto his finger.
Completely harmless when you touch it, but bring it into contact with metal, and it's quite another story.
He wiped his finger, smearing the cream onto the surface of the table. For a moment, nothing happened. Then a wisp of acrid smoke twisted upwards in the air. The metal sizzled, and a jagged hole appeared.
It'll do that to just about any metal, Smithers explained. Very useful, if you need to break through a lock.
He took out a handkerchief and wiped his finger clean.
Anything else? Mrs. Jones asked.
Oh, yes, Mrs. J. You could say this is our pièce de résistance.
He picked up a brightly coloured box that Alex recognised at once as a Nintendo Game Boy Color.
What teenager will be complete without one of these?
He asked.
This one comes with 4 games, and the beauty of it is each game turns the computer into something quite different.
He showed Alex the first game.
If you insert Nemesis, the computer becomes a fax photocopier, which gives you direct contact with us and vice versa.
A second game.
Exocet turns the computer into an X-ray device. It has an audio function, too. The headphones are useful for eavesdropping. It's not as powerful as I'd like, but we're working on it. Speed Wars is a bug finder. I suggest you use it the moment you're shown to your room. And finally, Bomber Boy.
Do I get to play that one? Alex asked.
You can play all 4 of them, but as the name might suggest, this is actually a smoke bomb. You leave the game cartridge somewhere in a room and press start 3 times on the console, and it'll go off. Useful camouflage if you need to escape in a hurry.
Thank you, Smithers,
Mrs. Jones said.
My pleasure, Mrs. J.
Smithers stood up, his legs straining to take the huge weight.
I hope to see you again, Alex. I've never had to equip a boy before. I'm sure I'll be able to think up a whole host of quite delightful ideas.
He waddled off and disappeared through a door which clanged shut behind him. Mrs. Jones turned to Alex.
You leave tomorrow for Port Talon, she said. You'll be going under the name of Felix Lester.
She handed him a folder.
We've sent the real Felix Lester on holiday in Scotland. You'll find everything you need to know about him in here.
I'll read it in bed.
Good.
Suddenly she was serious, and Alex found himself wondering if she was herself a mother. If so, she could well have a son of his age. She took out a black and white photograph and laid it on the table. It showed a man in a white t-shirt and jeans. He was in his late 20s with blonde, close-cropped hair, a smooth face, the body of a dancer. The photograph was slightly blurred. It had been taken from a distance, as if with a hidden camera.
I want you to look at this, she said.
I'm looking.
His name is Yasin Grigorovich. He was born in Russia, but he now works for many countries. Iraq has employed him, also Serbia, Libya, and China.
What does he do? Asked Alex. Though looking at the cold face with its blank, hooded eyes, he could almost guess.
He's a contract killer, Alex. We believe he killed Ian Ryder.
There was a long pause. Alex stared at the photograph, trying to print it on his mind.
This photograph was taken 6 months ago in Cuba. It may have been a coincidence, but Herod Sale was there at the same time. The two of them might have met. And there is something else, she paused. Ryder used a code in the last message he sent. A single letter. Y.
Why for Yassin?
He must have seen Yassin somewhere in Port Talon. He wanted us to know.
Why are you telling me this now? Alex asked.
Because if you see him, if Yassin is anywhere near Sail Enterprises, I want you to contact us at once.
And then?
We'll pull you out. If Yassin finds out you're working for us, he'll kill you too.
Alex smiled. I'm too young to interest him, he said.
No.
Mrs. Jones took the photograph back.
Just remember, Alex Ryder, you're never too young to die.
Alex stood up.
You leave tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock,
Mrs. Jones said.
Be careful, Alex. And good luck.
Alex walked across the hangar, his footsteps echoing. Behind him, Mrs. Jones unwrapped a peppermint and slipped it into her mouth. Her breath always smelt faintly of mint. As head of special operations, how many men had she sent to their deaths? Ian Ryder, and maybe dozens more. Perhaps it was easier for her if her breath was sweet. There was a movement ahead of him, and he saw that the parachutists had got back from their jump. They were walking towards him, out of the darkness, with Wolf and the other men from K-Unit right at the front. Alex tried to step round them, but he found Wolf blocking his way.
You're leaving, Wolf said.
Somehow he must have heard that Alex's training was over.
Yes.
There was a long pause.
What happened on the plane?
He began.
Forget it, Wolf, Alex said. Nothing happened. You jumped and I didn't. That's all.
Wolf held out a hand. I want you to know I was wrong about you. I'm sorry I gave you such a hard time. But you're all right, and maybe one day it'd be good to work with you.
You never know, said Alex.
They shook.
Good luck, Cub.
Goodbye, Wolf. And Alex walked out into the night. Chapter 7 Physalia Physalis. The silver-grey Mercedes SL600 cruised down the motorway, travelling south. Alex was sitting in the front passenger seat, with so much soft leather around him that he could barely hear the 389-horsepower 6-litre engine that was carrying him towards the Sail complex, near Port Talon, Cornwall. But at 80 miles an hour, the engine was only idling. Alex could feel the power of the car. £100,000 worth of German engineering. One touch from the thin, unsmiling chauffeur, and the Mercedes would leap forward. This was a car that sneered at speed limits. Alex had been collected that morning from a converted church in Hampstead, North London. This was where Felix Lester lived. When the driver had arrived, Alex had been waiting with his luggage, and there had even been a woman, an MI6 operative, kissing him, telling him to clean his teeth, waving goodbye. As far as the driver was concerned, Alex was Felix. That morning, Alex had read through the file and knew that Lester went to a school called St. Anthony's, had 2 sisters, and a pet Labrador. His father was an architect. His mother designed jewellery. A happy family. His family, if anybody asked. How far is it to Port Talon? He asked. So far, the driver had hardly spoken a word. He answered Alex without looking at him.
A few hours. You want some music?
Got any John Lennon?
This wasn't his choice. According to the file, Felix Lester liked John Lennon.
No.
Forget it. I'll get some sleep.
He needed the sleep. He was still exhausted from the training and wondered how he would explain all the half-healed cuts and bruises if anyone saw under his shirt. Maybe he'd tell them he got bullied at school. He closed his eyes and allowed the leather to suck him into sleep. It was the feeling of the car slowing down that woke him. He opened his eyes and saw a fishing village, the blue sea beyond, a swathe of rolling green hills and a cloudless sky. It was a picture of a jigsaw puzzle, or perhaps a holiday brochure advertising a forgotten England. Seagulls swooped and cried overhead. An old tug, tangled nets, smoke and flaking paint, pulled into the quay. A few locals, fishermen and their wives, stood around watching. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon,
and the village was caught in the silvery, fragile light that comes at the end of a perfect spring day.
Port Talon, the driver said. He must have noticed Alex opening his eyes.
It's pretty.
Not if you're a fish.
They drove round the edge of the village and back inland, down a lane that twisted between strangely bumpy fields. Alex saw the ruins of buildings, half-crumbling chimneys and rusting metal wheels, and knew that he was looking at an old tin mine. They'd mined tin in Cornwall for 3,000 years, until one day the tin had run out. Now all that was left were the holes. A couple of kilometers down the lane, a linked metal fence sprang up. It was brand new, 10 meters high, topped with razor wire. Arc lamps on scaffolding towers stood at regular intervals, and there were huge signs, red on white. You could have read them from the next county. Sale Enterprises, strictly private.
Trespassers will be shot, Alex muttered to himself.
He remembered what Mrs. Jones had told him. He's more or less got his own private army. He's acting as if he's got something to hide.
Well, that was certainly his own first impression. The whole complex was somehow shocking, alien to the sloping hills and fields. The car reached the main gate, where there was a security cabin and an electronic barrier. A guard in a blue and grey uniform with S.E. printed on his jacket waved them through. The barrier lifted automatically, and then they were following a long, straight road over a stretch of land that had somehow been hammered flat, with an airstrip on one side and a cluster of 4 high-tech buildings on the other. The buildings were large, smoked glass and steel, each one joined to the next by a covered walkway. There were 2 aircraft next to the landing strip, a helicopter and a small cargo plane. Alex was impressed. The whole complex must have been about 5 kilometers square. It was quite an operation. The Mercedes came to a roundabout with a fountain at the center, swept round it and continued up towards a fantastic sprawling house. It was Victorian, red brick topped with copper domes and spires that had long ago turned green. There must have been at least 60 windows on the 5 floors facing the drive. It was a house that just didn't know when to stop. The Mercedes pulled up at the main entrance and the driver got out.
Follow me.
What about my luggage? Alex asked.
It'll be brought.
Alex and the driver went through the front door and into a hall dominated by a huge canvas.
Judgment Day.
The end of the world, painted 4 centuries ago as a swirling mass of doomed souls and demons. There were works of art everywhere. Watercolors and oils, prints, drawings, sculptures in stone and bronze, all crowded together with nowhere for the eye to rest. Alex followed the driver along a carpet so thick that he almost bounced. He was beginning to feel claustrophobic, and was relieved when they passed through a door into a vast room that was practically bare.
Mr. Sale will be here shortly, the driver said, and left.
Alex looked around him. This was a modern room with a curving steel desk near the center, carefully positioned halogen lights and a spiral staircase leaning down from a perfect circle cut in the ceiling high above. One entire wall consisted of a single sheet of glass, and walking over to it, Alex realized that he was looking at a gigantic aquarium. The sheer size of the thing drew him towards it. It was hard to imagine how many thousands of liters of water the glass held back, but he was surprised to see that the tank was empty. There were no fish, although it was big enough to hold a shark. Then something moved in the turquoise shadows, and Alex gasped at the mixture of horror and wonderment as the biggest jellyfish he had ever seen drifted into view. The main body of the creature was a shimmering, pulsating mass of white and mauve, shaped roughly like a cone. Beneath it, a mass of tentacles covered with circular stingers twisted in the water, at least 10 meters long. As the jellyfish moved, or drifted, in an artificial current, its tentacles writhed against the glass, so that it looked almost as if it was trying to break out. It was the single, most awesome and repulsive thing Alex had ever seen.
Fissilia fissilis.
The voice came from behind him, and Alex twisted round to see a man coming down the last of the stairs. Herod Sale was short. He was so short that Alex's first impression was that he was looking at a reflection that had somehow been distorted. In his immaculate and expensive black suit, with gold signet ring and brightly polished black shoes. He looked like a scaled-down model of a multimillionaire businessman. His skin was very dark, so that his teeth flashed when he smiled. He had a round, bald head and very horrible eyes. The grey irises were too small, completely surrounded by white. Alex was reminded of tadpoles before they hatch. When Sale stood next to him, the eyes were almost at the same level as his, and held less warmth than the jellyfish.
"Portuguese man of war,"
Sale continued. He had a heavy accent brought with him from the Beirut marketplace.
"It's beautiful, don't you think?"
"I wouldn't keep one as a pet," Alex said.
"I came upon this one when I was diving in the South China Sea."
Sale gestured at a glass display case, and Alex noticed three harpoon guns and a collection of knives resting in velvet slots.
"I love to kill fish," Sale went on. "But when I saw this specimen of Physalia physalis, I knew I had to capture it and keep it. You see, it reminds me of myself."
"It's 99% water. It has no brains, no guts, no anus." Alex had dredged up the facts from somewhere and spoken them before he knew what he was doing. Sale glanced at him, then turned back to the creature hovering over him in its tank.
"It's an outsider," he said. "It drifts on its own, ignored by the other fish. It is silent, and yet it demands respect. You see the nematocysts, Mr. Lester, the stinging cells. If you were to find yourself wrapped in those, it would be an exquisite death."
"Call me Alex," Alex said. He'd meant to say Felix, but somehow it had slipped out. It was the most stupid, the most amateurish mistake he could have made. But he had been thrown by the way Sale had appeared and by the slow hypnotic dance of the jellyfish. The grey eyes squirmed.
"I thought your name was Felix."
"My friends call me Alex."
"Why?"
"After Alex Ferguson. I'm a big fan of Manchester United." It was the first thing Alex could think of. But he'd seen a football poster in Felix Lester's bedroom, and knew that at least he'd chosen the right team. Sale smiled.
"That's most amusing, Alex, it shall be. And I hope we will be friends, Alex. You are a very lucky boy. You won the competition, and you are going to be the first teenager to try out my Stormbreaker. But this is also lucky, I think, for me. I want to know what you think of it. I want you to tell me what you like, what you don't."
The eyes dipped away, and suddenly he was businesslike.
"We have only 3 days until the launch," he said. "We'd better get a bloody move on, as my father used to say. I'll have my man take you to your room, and tomorrow morning, first thing, you must get to work. There's a math program you should try, also languages. All the software has been developed here at Sale Enterprises. Of course, we've talked to children, we've gone to teachers, to education experts, but you, my dear Alex, you will be worth more to me than all of them put together."
As he had talked, Sale had become more and more animated, carried away by his own enthusiasm. He'd become a completely different man. Alex had to admit that he'd taken an immediate dislike to Herod Sale. And no wonder Blunt and the people of MI6 mistrusted him. But now he was forced to think again. He was standing opposite one of the richest men in England, a man who had decided, out of the goodness of his heart, to give a huge gift to British schools. Just because he was small and slimy, that didn't necessarily make him an enemy. Perhaps Blunt was wrong, after all.
"Ah, here's my man now," Sale said. "And about bloody time."
The door had opened, and a man had come in, dressed in the black suit and tails of an old-fashioned butler. He was as tall and thin as his master was short and round, with a thatch of ginger hair above a face so pale it was almost paper white. From a distance it had looked as if he was smiling, but as he drew closer, Alex gasped. The man had two horrendous scars, one each side of his mouth, twisting up all the way to his ears. It was as if someone had attempted to cut his face in half. The scars were a gruesome shade of mauve. There were smaller, fainter scars where his cheeks had once been stitched.
"This is Mr. Grin," Sale said. "He changed his name after his accident."
Accident? Alex found it hard not to stare at the terrible wounds.
Mr. Green used to work in a circus. It was a novelty knife-throwing act. For the climax, he used to catch a spinning knife between his teeth. But then one night his elderly mother came to see the show. She waved to him from the front row, and he got his timing wrong. He's worked for me for a dozen years now, and although his appearance may be displeasing, he is loyal and efficient. Don't try to talk with him, by the way. He has no tongue. Mr. Green said.
Nice to meet you, Alex muttered.
Take him to the blue room, Sale commanded.
He turned to Alex. You're fortunate that one of our nicest rooms has come up free here in the house. We had a security man staying there, but he left us quite suddenly.
Oh? Why was that? Alex asked casually.
I have no idea. One moment he was here, the next he was gone.
Sale smiled again. I hope you won't do the same, Alex.
Mr. Grin gestured at the door,
and leaving Herod Sale standing in front of his huge captive, Alex left the room. He was led along a passage past more works of art, up a staircase and then along a wide corridor, with thick wood-paneled doors and chandeliers. Alex assumed that the main house was used for entertaining. Sale himself must live here. But the computers would be constructed in the modern buildings he had seen opposite the airstrip. Presumably, he would be taken there tomorrow. His room was at the far end. It was a large room with a four-poster bed and a window looking out onto the fountain. Darkness had fallen, and the water, cascading 10 meters through the air over a semi-naked statue that looked remarkably like Herod Sale, was eerily illuminated by a dozen concealed lights. Next to the window was a table with an evening meal already laid out for him, ham, cheese, salad. His bag was lying on the bed. He went over to it, a Nike sports bag, and examined it. When he had closed it up, he had inserted 3 hairs into the zip, trapping them in the metal teeth. They were no longer there. Alex opened the bag and went through it. Everything was exactly as it had been when he had packed, but he was certain that the sports bag had been expertly and methodically searched. He took out the Game Boy Color, inserted the Speed Wars cartridge, and pressed the start button 3 times. At once the screen lit up with a green rectangle, the same shape as the room. He lifted the Game Boy up and swung it around him, following the line of the walls. A red flashing dot suddenly appeared on the screen. He walked forward, holding the Game Boy in front of him. The dot flashed faster, more intensely. He had reached a picture, hanging next to the bathroom, a squiggle of colors that looked suspiciously like a Picasso. He put the Game Boy down and carefully lifted the canvas off the wall. The bug was taped behind it, a black disc about the size of a 10-pence piece. Alex looked at it for a minute, wondering why it was there.
Security?
Or was Sale such a control freak that he had to know what his guests were doing every minute of the day and night? Alex put the picture back. There was only one bug in the room. The bathroom was clean. He ate his dinner, showered, and got ready for bed. As he passed the window, he noticed activity in the grounds near the fountain. There were lights shining out of the modern buildings. 3 men, all dressed in white overalls, were driving towards the house in an open-top Jeep. 2 more men walked past. These were security guards, dressed in the same uniform as the man at the gate. They were both carrying semi-automatic machine guns. Not just a private army, but a well-armed one. He got into bed. The last person who had slept here had been his uncle, Ian Ryder. Had he seen something, looking out of the window? Had he heard something? What could have happened that meant he had to die? Sleep took a long time coming to the dead man's bed. Chapter 8. Looking for Trouble. Alex saw it the moment he opened his eyes. It would have been obvious to anyone who had slept in the bed, but of course nobody had slept there since Ian Ryder had been killed. It was a triangle of white slipped into a fold in the canopy above the 4-poster bed. You had to be lying on your back to see it, like Alex was now. It was out of his reach. He had to balance a chair on the mattress, and then stand on the chair to reach it. Wobbling, almost falling, he finally managed to trap it between his fingers and pull it out. In fact, it was a square piece of paper, folded twice. Someone had drawn on it, a strange design, with what looked like a reference number beneath it. CL475/19. There wasn't very much of it, but Alex recognized Ian Ryder's handwriting. But what did it mean? He pulled on some clothes, went over to the table, and took out a sheet of plain paper. Quickly, he wrote a brief message in block capitals.